This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning, everyone. Can you give me a thumbs up if you can hear me all right? Okay. So glad to be here, be connected to you all. And I'm sorry I'm here at a distance, but I'm practicing with you there. My heart is with you. We're practicing together. If at any point you can't understand me or we have some connectivity issues, please just give me a little sign, wave at me, and I'll know to back up and clarify or repeat myself. Today, I wanted to talk a little bit about a kind of famous teaching story. It's sometimes called Deshan Carries His Bundle. This is a classic teaching story from our tradition. And it's in the koan collection, The Gateless Gate, or the Mumenkan. And it's case number 28 there. So to give you a little background about this story, our titular character, this guy named Deshan, he was a longtime practitioner in another school of Buddhism. And he specialized in one text. He ended up becoming an expert in the Diamond Sutra. And so throughout northern China, where this guy lived and practiced, he used to go around teaching from this text. He would go around teaching from the Diamond Sutra. And throughout parts of northern China, he started to have quite a reputation. He started to have a lot of people show up for his talks and be very interested and energized about what he was saying. And I can see this this monk, with his backpack full of the Diamond Sutra, all printed out or all written out on scrolls, and all his notes and all the collected accoutrement that he had to carry around with him. And so, and sometimes in little ink paintings of Deshan, sometimes you see them, he has this towering, absolutely towering backpack, you can see him going off. And I really relate to that. I'm not being an expert on anything, but bouncing back and forth from the West Coast and the East Coast. We're at home now, just right outside of DC. But I travel back and forth a lot to Jikoji. Mostly my is, charging cables, investments, junk food or whatever I'm carrying with me. But as we read through this story, maybe you'll start to pick up on some other themes. So anyway, when he would travel around, he would travel to these places and people would come to see him. They'd want to hear his Dharma talks, his scholarly expositions. And he started to get a reputation enough that they started calling him, the Diamond Joe. They started giving him this nickname, like the Diamond Master. Here he comes. Here comes the Diamond Sutra Master. And so in traveling around and in mixing with these different Buddhist communities, he started hearing about this emerging school. Well, Zen had been around for a while now, but it was picking up a lot in this time in the South. So Deshan decides, I'm going to find out what this is about. A matter of fact, in some versions of this story, Deshan he hears that they're practicing Buddhism in this different way, this Zen Buddhism. And they're practicing this mind-to-mind transmission, and they're saying that real Buddhism happens outside of the sutras. They're saying all these heretical things, seemingly on the surface, very heretical things. But you have to remember that Buddhism, when brought to one of at least the stories we use, Buddhism being brought to China is brought there by Bodhidharma. Sometimes we call him our first ancestor. And Bodhidharma, he laid out Zen as having kind of three or four touchstones, three or four kind of pillars that we understand Zen to be. And I find it really helpful sometimes to come back to this touchstone. What is Zen? What is this practice? What are we doing? So Bodhidharma says that first, it's not reliant on the written word, that it's a second, it's a special transmission outside of scripture or outside of sutras even. And the third, it's a direct pointing to one's mind. Fourth, seeing one's nature and becoming Buddha. So that sounds terrible. I would put my backpack on and I would go right down there to the south and I would tell them how wrong they are. But in some versions of the story, that's exactly what happened. Deshan says, I'll show them the correct Buddhism, or I'll teach them the correct interpretation of the way, or something like that. And from a Zen perspective, and from a psychotherapist's perspective, when I see somebody who's going to go out on a quest or is going to undertake some really arduous journey, it wasn't simple traveling inland across China in those days. Still not simple. But starting off on a journey with that kind of energy, I'll show them, I'll fix them. That's wrong, you know. So using that kind of hate or anger or that kind of energy to be the thing that propels us out the door, that's a dangerous energy to constantly be hitching your cart, hitching your cart to. But there he goes. Deshan puts on his pack and he travels down to the south, this long trip. Now, so who cares? Who cares if the guys in the south, the guys and gals in the south are practicing Zen and they're practicing this way? Isn't the Diamond Sutra from the same body that is the Prajnaparamita Sutra that we get the Heart Sutra from, and the Diamond Sutra, and all these texts that are also core texts for us Zennies? But the Diamond Sutra, and now this is, who knows what was in Deshan's heart, but the Diamond Sutra teaches that Buddhahood is only achieved through many lifetimes of practice and correct understanding, maybe. My notes here say correct concentration, correct study over many lifetimes. And Zen doesn't disagree with that. Zen says, yeah, sure. And it's also right here and now, right? So it's both. But here's Deshan. I'm going to fix them. I'm going to do this. I'm going to head there and correct their understanding. When reading more about this koan and preparing some notes for this talk, I came across a quote from Aitken Roshi, Robert Aitken Roshi, who says, if your defenses are impervious, no one can get in, and no one can get out. There is no fissure through which the vine of your life can find its way to the sunshine. So Deshan, on his way down to the south, he ends up stopping by a roadside tea cellar, a place that would offer refreshments for travelers. So at the base of this mountain, Deshan goes into this old tea house and he sits down, and this old woman appears and serves him tea. And I wanted to pause there because in a lot of our stories, you'll get something like this old woman or some woman or a nun. It's kind of shameful that how often women are just left nameless, or all the women are compiled into one aggregate character, the woman, a woman. And so even in this version of the koan that I'm about to read, they say things like patriarch, but now we say things like ancestor to be a little more gender neutral, a little more inclusive. Inclusive. But as I was thinking about that, I wrote in the margin, here we go. Another koan starting with a nameless, faceless, uncredited woman. But as I sat with that, I also realized, like a lot of people with disabilities and differences, they're also not named and not counted. But there's also a spiritual power to that. On the other side, sometimes, at least from a Zen understanding, to be nameless, to be faceless, to be completely unhindered by things like that is sometimes a blessing in disguise. Doesn't make it better, but at least it gives us room to function sometimes, huh? So anyway, he sits down to have his tea and to get his refreshments. And this old woman is moving about and serving tea. And I can picture Deshan watching her move through the tea house and thinking, there's a quality to her, how she handles herself. So he orders some tea and some tea cakes. And while it's important to also note about this story, one of these tea cakes, one of these refreshments he's ordering, the Chinese characters for the hanshi for this can also be read as refresh, but also as to light up, to light up your mind, right? So he sits down and he says, yes, I'll have the cakes and I'll have some tea. And the old woman says, okay, what's all of that in your backpack? What are you carrying? What is that? And Deshan says, oh, this here is the Diamond Sutra. And all these commentaries on the Diamond Sutra by eminent monks, you know. This is, I don't even have to picture him as being really inflated. But just picturing a guy saying, this is, what's this? This is my life's work. This is it. And the old woman being like, oh, really? The Diamond Sutra? Oh. He said, yes, you know, I'm Diamond Zhou. I'm the king of the Diamond Sutra. I'm this Diamond Sutra expert. We've all been at a party and somebody says, oh, what do you do? Well, I am a this and that. And the first one to ever do that. So the woman's listening to him. Oh, really? Oh, okay. Diamond Sutra, you say. Oh, okay. So the woman goes to hand him his cakes and says, I'll give you your cake. I'll give you this tea cake if you can answer me one question about the Diamond Sutra. Deshan at this point must have felt like I can answer any question about the Diamond Sutra. I've been on this book tour for the last 10 years, you know. Answer me one question about the Diamond Sutra, and cake's yours. He says, okay. Okay, I'll take that bet. And the old woman said, in your Diamond Sutra, in your Diamond Sutra, it says, the mind of the past is unattainable. The mind of the present is unattainable, and the mind of the future is unattainable. So tell me, which mind do you want to refresh? Which mind are you here to light up? It's like asking, okay, you want free lunch? You. What mind are you going to have that free lunch with? Deshan couldn't even speak. No. He had no answer. There was nothing in all of these commentaries that he's been carrying around for years and years and years. There was nothing in those texts that could prepare him for this question. He was lost. So he thought and he thought and he thought, and he couldn't come up with an answer. And I imagine him finally flagging down the old woman and saying, look, I gotta eat. And I don't know what to say here. Tell me, little old lady, who are you studying with? Because I think Deshan's getting a whiff that, hey, there must be a Zen master around this place. Everybody stinks of it. You know, everybody is really kind of holding it down in this neighborhood. And the old woman relented and said, oh, yes, there is. There is a wonderful teacher right up this hill here, right up this mountain. Why don't you go study with him? Why don't you go see what it's about? You'll find on that mountain Master Long Tang. I don't know, maybe I think it's Master Dragon Pool, Dragon Pond or something like that. Maybe like the pond out back of Jokoji, was the Dragon Pool, the Dragon Swamp. So Deshan, with his belly satisfied and his mind aflame, very curious, he heads up this mountain to talk to Long Tang. I was thinking about that. I was thinking, what would I say? What would I say if I was in this hot seat? I was seated there and someone said, okay, you're a Zen monk, whatever that means. Tell me one good word of Zen. What would you say? You know. And in thinking of that, recently we went camping. We were in a national park in the Midwest, and I have my usual curse, which is on the last day of camping, it rains. So I'm forever, leaving the campground wet and smoky. But as it started to rain that last evening, we dove into our tents and we're watching the fading light and the rain hitting the tent and the leaves falling and decorating the tent and sliding down. And hey, camping in the rain's not so bad. This is a beautiful moment. Just to be here, it's beautiful. It's enough. And then the next morning, packing up the tent in the rain. Oh, this is so hard. Why do I do this? Why do I come here? I need better hobbies. This is tough. Oh, don't get it in the mud. Don't do that. Oh, no. Oh, here we go. Oh, I'm soaked. Oh. And then, we're hanging the tent in a friend's garage to dry. We get a warm shower, a meal. Next morning, we get up, the tent's dry. And it's clean. It's been washed clean by the rain. Oh, we can pack it up. We can go home now. I kept thinking about lying there and thinking, oh, this is the rain. And then the next morning, oh, this is the rain. This is the rain. And then the next day, look what the rain did. Look what it did. The mind of the past, the mind of the present, the mind of the future. Well, it was just one guy. It was just one rain. It was just one tent. What changed? What was different? Maybe it wasn't just one guy. Maybe he was in flux and he had a lot of attitudes and opinions and ideas about how camping should go or about his Sunday curse that it's always going to rain on the last day of camping. But that's how we are, right? All loaded up. Just full of our ideas, just the backpack full to the brim and towering over us, all of our pockets full. We can get loaded up on our writings, our ideas, our stories, our egos. And then sometimes, if we're lucky, there's someone along the way who says, well, how about that? What about that moment or that thought? And we get to develop our eye a little more. We get to practice. We get to get reconnected with ourselves and our practice a little more. I think that's part of what we're meant to do. I don't think there's any grand scheme or, meaning of life like that. That's a big trap. No. But I do feel on the day to day quite compelled at times to see that spark in myself and to see it in others, to see that charcoal in somebody and kind of fan it to flame, trying to coax it to life so that they can, have that flame of the Dharma. But what happens when we're walking along and suddenly we feel the weight of all of our stories and feel the weight of all of our conditioning, our habits? And that old woman was able to break through Deshan's ego wall, was able to create a chink in the armor to find that gap. So maybe we don't need our concepts, Maybe we don't need all of that thinking, that idea. That old woman is a great practice model. What a great way, without being too stinky and pulling out her own soapbox that says, well, Zen is a lot better, or my teacher is a lot more this or that. She just fed a guy and saw a moment and was able to give him a little push. What an excellent way to care for people, to feed them. It's very Chinese, too. Now, there's nothing wrong with academic study. It's required. It's needed in Zen. We have great practice models and tons of resources for us to understand ourselves, understand our minds better. But we need to understand how it works or how it is true in our lives. We need to see it applied. We need to see it in our actions with each other. It can't be a dead thing on a page. because then Buddhism becomes theoretical, becomes intellectual discourse, and it doesn't become an applied practice. And that's what we need. That's what we're here for, to really practice, to not just stay in our heads. And that's kind of one of the issues with using any of these stories. There's so many interesting points to be made or ways to connect with it. So even outside of this talk, this idea, language is, well, language belongs to this linear discursive mind. Language is not life. It's a map. It's not the territory. So we spend a lot of our lives trying to learn a lot, and then, at least in this practice, trying to let go of a lot. And I was thinking about how I am practicing that in my life right now. What am I doing about that? Okay, I have an understanding. I have a glimpse of something, or even the sutra from 1300 years ago. Not sutra, I'm sorry, this koan from 1300 years ago. All of a sudden, it's like it's alive for me. Well, don't stop there. Go a little further. And for me, that was like this week, it was like, sorry, I was wrong. And then we can feel that we're walking through our lives with a full backpack, a full load of sutras and their commentaries, the sutra of my ego, the sutra of my opinions. I have a lot of commentaries on that. It's heavy, it gets heavy. And we see somebody dancing in a field, and we say, oh, I can't dance, it's too heavy. We've all been there. We've all let our intellectualizations get in the way of even things we know, things we care about. And that's really what an old woman like that was doing, a tea seller. She wasn't letting his intellectualization keep him stuck to the point where he is. Just give him a little push. Right downhill, up a mountain. Desha, don't let your thoughts and ideas crowd out this moment. Don't let everything you're carrying get in the way of your life. So there's, actually, the second half to this story. And the koan for the second half goes a bit like this. So, yes, Deshan makes it up the mountain. Surprise. He makes it up the mountain. What happens next, then? I want to know that story. So, one day, Deshan, asking after a long time for instruction late into the night, Long Tan finally said one day, it's late. Why don't you go to bed? Deshan thanked him, made his bows. He raised the door curtain and left. Upon taking a step outside, Deshan realized how dark it had become. He turned back and said, teacher, teacher, it's pitch blackout. So Long Tan lit a lantern and handed it to Deshan. And just as Deshan received this lantern, Long Tan blew it out. At this, Deshan became suddenly enlightened and made a deep bow. Long Tan said, okay, what have you realized? Deshan replied, "From now on, I will not doubt the words of the old master who was renowned here and everywhere under the sun." The following day, Long Tan ascended the teaching seat and declared, "There is a man among you who has fangs like a tree of swords and a mouth like a bowl of blood. Strike him and he won't turn his head. Someday he will settle atop another peak and establish our way there." At this, Deshan brought forth his backpack, sutras with all those commentaries, and dumped them out in front of the hall. And he held up a lit torch, pointing to the pile, and said, "Even if you have exhausted all of this doctrine, it's like placing a hair in empty space. Even if you've learned all of these vital points, all of the truths contained herein, it's just like a drop of water being thrown into a ravine." He then set fire to all of the sutras and commentaries, made his bows, and left. I'm just thinking about that lamp, that torch, that darkness, all of the words in the Diamond Sutra, but brilliant light. Yeah. And that light, holding out that lantern, that was like Deshan and his words. He's navigating by intellect. And it's worked. I mean, we can all relate with that. I've used my skills, my abilities, my looks, my talents, whatever it is, my intellect, and I've gotten by. I've figured it out. But that light, like candlelight, it casts such a narrow beam for us. It's, you know, if you've ever held a candle out in the darkness, something that you've probably experienced at Chukoji, if you've ever held a literal candle out into the darkness, you know how dark that is and how slowly we creep along. So that was his world. He was able to create an understanding, albeit an intellectual one, that enabled him to navigate his world, but mainly a world of intellect. Is that all there is? Just a world of our minds and intellect? Maybe a better question, is that all there is that can fit into your mind? What about what doesn't fit into your mind, that you can't grasp with your intellect? Can all of your understandings about yourself even be contained in your head? That's why we have sayings in Zen, things like, "The eye cannot see itself." Can't keep going on bumbling through this world with this candle of ignorance out in front of us, just seeing a few feet with our ghoulish illuminated faces. That darkness surrounding us, our ordinary perception, our limited perception, here it is. Here's your mind on fire, burning wildly against the dark. And here you are, staring at a point of flame, right? Here we are, trying to make sense of it. And we have to grasp through our life. And we have real action from the old tea seller. Boom. and real action, real teachings from long time. Can we be like Deshaun, following that something, that gut, that chink in the armor, that crack in the wall in the ego that says, I have to find out what that's about. I have to cultivate this. And in that moment, blowing out that candle, going from a moment of deep conceptualized understanding, conceptualization, intellectualization, to beyond our concepts, beyond our understanding. To be in darkness like that is to see it all at once. All at once. Yeah, but what do I do? What do I do about this here now, my life? my struggles, the bills I have to pay. My suffering. It's so different, so special. And I'm sure many of you know the story of the empty boat, right? There's this great little axiom about the empty boat. Usually goes something like a monk that was trying so hard to practice and kept being disturbed by his life, being disturbed by other people at the monastery. And we can all relate to that, right? You know, I'd love to sit more. I'd love to do Zazen more. I just look at my life, though. You know, how could I? Yeah. So this monk is trying to practice, and he keeps getting assailed by his life. So he decides that he's going to go down to the lake. He's going to get into a boat, and he's just going to drift out into the center of the lake where no one can bother him, and he can get some real Zazen done. And there he is sitting there, and bam, just like that, another boat slams into his boat. Bam. And, you know, he turns around like, what? How could you be so absent-minded, so foolish? So, and then he sees the boat is empty. That other boat is adrift, and it ran into his. And immediately, we know that feeling. And you feel so sheepish, but who disturbs my meditation? Who disturbs my equanimity? Bam. So every time I get feeling like that lately, I just think to myself, oh, it's an empty boat. I feel myself getting stressed about traffic, about Zoom's connectivity. Oh, it's an empty boat. I feel myself latching onto my concepts, my identity, all that crap in my backpack. It's an empty boat. Deshaun relied on words, and relying on anything is not intimacy. What a marvelous moment when darkness and light meet each other. Let go of your eyes. Let them fail you. It's only the blind man who's not tricked by his eyes. So listen carefully to the words of the deaf monk. He had the light long before the old tea seller gave him a peek. Okay. I think we might have just a moment or two before someone rings that lunch bell. And now, oh, I'd like to feed that mind of the present. I'd like to come up with you up to the dining hall there and have a nice big meal with you. But I think we have a few minutes before that bell rings. We might have time for a question or two, or comments, or strong rebukes, as the case may be. Yes, Randy.
Yeah, while you were speaking and the whole story, I kept thinking back to the that whole series of training the ox, the 10 different stages, and when he and the one I could really relate to is the one and when he goes back into the city, into the town to be among the regular people, because that's where practice is. I don't know. I mean, yeah, that's what I felt. And I've heard that koan before, and that's one I really love. The old lady at the, and I've heard different variations. Once she was sitting on the side of a road and
Yeah. Oop, I think you might have froze on us there, Randy.
even in our own lives, we get slapped by life. And it says, wake up a little bit, So those two things, going back to the 10th picture of taking the ox down into the road of normal people, and that's where we learn, I think. So
Yeah.
hopefully.
That tenth ox herding picture. There's this collection of these 10 pictures, and they're kind of used as a way to talk about the spiritual practice. I'm being very careful not to talk about spiritual progress because that's a trap, maybe. But the idea is going through these 10 ox herding pictures, and the final one is returns to the marketplace. And what a beautiful thing, because it's kind of saying, hey, your practice is not complete unless it descends the mountain, unless it goes back to the dusty marketplace, the dusty world. And so you have to go back down into Los Gatos or wherever you're headed, and you have to, with bliss-bestowing hands, as the Rinzai tradition will say, you have to be able to kind of offer it. And the craziest thing is bliss-bestowing hands quite often are empty, But yeah, that what a great reminder, Randy. Thank you, thank you. It's like, how can I coax that spark in other people? How can I help them along on their practice? How can I help myself along in my practice too. Thank you. Any other questions? Oh, Nora.
Thank you, Oshin. And thank you also for the simple examples you gave of your own life when that empty boat hits you. My question is, right now there is a lot of real anxiety and fear in the world from the pandemic. To things that are happening, but also just, within our minds.
Yeah.
So some of them are empty boats. Some of them are quite heavy boats. But so the question is, you also, as a therapist and a Zen Buddhist, what is your practical advice when anxiety, as that empty boat hits you, how to deal with that empty boat on a daily basis? I know, big question.
Yeah. Don't hold back. Yeah. I take comfort in quotes like from Suzuki Roshi, who would say, just shine one corner of the world. Sometimes I'm faced with a lot that's affecting me, my community, the people I care about, and how could I not be upset? And on one hand, yeah, we just have to shine one corner of the world. I don't have to solve everything, but I have to do something. So what am I going to do about it? I'm going to do something. The problem is not that there's problems, I think. I think the problem is that there's so much apathy and inaction in me that keeps me down and keeps me from responding. And we need to respond. We need to show up in our lives. We need to show up in our communities. We need to show up next week when we go to vote. We need to do that. That's kind of on the one hand, I'm not saying that's small mind thinking, but there is a kind of more big mind thinking. We could go a little deeper. And I'm trying to remember the koan, and wouldn't I be just the Diamond Sutra King if I could actually quote this whole koan right back to you? You'd be so impressive. But there is this koan where a monk goes to visit a teacher, and he's out tilling the fields or hoeing rice or he's farming. And they have this tete-a-tete, as a lot of these koans are. They go back and forth a little bit. And he's asking them about, what is your tilling rice here? What good is that to the world? What are you doing? And his response was, what do you call the world? And that's that slap that Randy's talking about. The compassionate backhand that we need sometimes of like, but, and I realize I do that too. I'm looking at the comment section on something, and I can't believe they gave that guy a keyboard. I mean, it's just horrific. And he's wrong. And somebody needs to tell him he's wrong and all these things. And I feel myself getting, my world is getting totally upside down based on this digital ether. I'm not even sure if that guy really even believes that he's posting. I don't know. And really, getting in there is not going to do anything. Certainly not for my peace of mind. Certainly not for world peace. So it's just like, okay, well, the world's on fire. Yeah, well, what do you call the world? Well, I've got to do my laundry. I've got to check my voter registration. These are all the things I have to do today. Show up for my nonprofits. Show up for my sangha. Show up for my friends. Do all these things. I just have to shine that one corner. I have to find it. I need to do that. I just need to find that purchase. And for me, there's a great teaching that the Zen peacemakers use. They have the three tenets of the Zen peacemakers, which are not knowing, bearing witness, and then loving action. It's the idea, just to kind of wrap up my long-winded babble here. I can go into a situation with a clear and empty mind, an open and receiving heart. Just see what's there, not knowing. Then what comes up? Bearing witness. There's a problem here. There's a problem. Don't just see what's there and then loving action. If we follow them in order, they kind of work. And that last one, loving action, it arises of itself. If I'm clear and empty, the appropriate action usually is right there. It just needs me to attune to it, attend to it, and do it. I don't know. 80% of the time, it works all the time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Oh, Thank you. I don't know how much time, if any, we have left. I blame the time change, the daylight savings, and being three time zones away, but really I never know what time it is. Are we okay? All right. Maybe one more and then we wrap up if we have another question. Karen? Yeah.
So could you say a bit more about like we use our intellect and our study and the sutras to kind of shine the light, and then what is, could you say a bit about letting go of that and then shining the light in other ways? Like, please say a bit more about those things.
I'll try. Yeah. You know, maybe you could help me too. But yeah, I think about, you know, the words that Corbin said. He said, we're supposed to be in the most direct contact with ourselves. It's the clearest contact, direct contact with ourselves. And I like that as a concept. Whether that's the small self, knowing what kind of distortions and crap I'm bringing to this situation. And then also the larger self, you know. I want to be in the most clear and direct contact with myself. Big self, all of us, everything, all of it. And I think, yeah, and as Corbin also said, we're always sending and receiving that kind of light. And perhaps that's the tension also for Deshan. That push and pull on that darkness, or that push and maybe it's like light seeking light is the tension. But whatever that tension is, where they meet, that's mysticism, right? That's our practice, right? True spiritual practice is like that. It's an experience sometimes of receiving that light, and then getting sometimes really frustrated because it's like I can't even articulate it. I can't. And so that's why we might say not reliant on written word, not reliant on speech. Or we say things, it's like a finger pointing at the moon. You know, we say things like that because we're trying not to get caught on those words. But when we get glimpses like that, that push and pull, I think that, or that gap, it's for me, that's a place to enter. Yeah. It's funny because blowing out a candle all of a sudden became the illuminating event for Deshan. Yeah. He was breathing life into Deshan. Yeah. Say more about your question.
I was trying to understand that, like, the way we understand is with the mind, and when we read the sutras or watch the talk or do anything, we're always trying to make sense of things by the mind. And so in the story, like for Deshan, he was doing that too with his Diamond Sutra and telling the stories of Diamond Sutra and the commentaries of Diamond Sutra. However, Longshan understood it without the mind. And so I was just wondering how to, like, what action, like, went for myself when I have an impulse to understand the Dharma, I would like start reading, start studying, or just sitting. But then it's not, it's like, if there is like a way that I can exert my trust in the practice outside of the study and the scriptures, then what are some of these ways? And of course, sitting is one of those ways, and serving the community is one of those ways. And I was just like wanting to hear your thoughts on that, you know, like ways in which we can shine the light, point to the big moon, without the use of scriptures. What would you say that is?
Yeah, you know, Dogen said that it's an open hand, an empty hand, that actually contains everything. So I could just feel the constriction on one side of myself, of wanting to know, of wanting to grasp, of wanting to understand and comprehend. And then also knowing on the other side, it's like completely vast and open. And it's not separate from anything that I am, you know? And those both exist in me, you know. That's who we are. I just think about how our brains, we just think they're so important, you know. My brain is the most important organ in my body. So says my brain, right? It's like, this is like dominating this kind of narrative. But, you know, I've seen you dance, Karanji. I've seen you tango, you know, literally. It's not, you know, it's like in a dance. It's not in those steps, right? It's not in the formula. It's not that. And we've got these sutras and these words, you know, the Sandokai. It just says, you know, it's not limited to these words. You know, but it responds to the inquiring impulse. It's like filling a silver bowl with snow. It's like a white heron flying in front of the moon. We have it, yeah. We have it like this. That, you know, even if we taste it and we touch it, it's like it's impossible sometimes to repeat, to offer back up. And there's in that tension is a lovely dance, a lovely mysticism. That's really beautiful. But It's just like dancing. I've had people come up to me and say, after Kinhin, you know, they say, after walking meditation, I don't know what happened. I just felt like the floor was walking me. And you say, yeah. Yeah, sometimes I know you know that feeling with dance, right? Well, you and your partner aren't you and your partner. You're not even two people as one. It's like, it's the room is dancing. It's all alive, right? So that's what I think we're talking about. What do I know about dancing other than watching you? So that's the other piece of that too. You're right. By showing up and serving and by working with the Sangha, right? Because we don't have 360 vision. One of the Zen aphorisms is they call somebody a board carrying man. You know, it's this idea of like, we walk around going, yeah, I can see it all while shouldering this heavy board, missing half the room, at least at any given point. So I think we need Sangha to help us with blind spots and to help us support us along. So maybe I'll leave it there. I just thought of a fun little thought. When asked about Maitreya Buddha, Thich Nhat Hanh was asked once about Maitreya Buddha, the Buddha of the future, the Buddha, maybe the last Buddha to come, and will come in 10,000 kalpas, like the amount of time it takes for the world to be born, to die, 10,000 of those. That's when the next big Buddha is going to come, maybe. So Thich Nhat Hanh was asked about Maitreya Buddha, and all he said was, I think Maitreya Buddha is the Sangha. I think it's the Sangha. I think, and I love that idea, the Buddha to come, the next Buddha, it's us. And it's not going to be just one of us. It's us all together. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for your practice.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.